The headlines this hour. Iran's leader tells Palestinian leaders that the fight with those occupying Palestine amounts to resistance against oppression and arrogance. Iran extends a monitoring deal with the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency for 1 month. Also in the headlines, the head of the World Health Organization says the COVID-19 pandemic keeps spreading as a result of, quote, scandalous inequity in vaccine distribution.
Welcome to the program.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says that Palestinians' fight against Israeli occupiers amounts to resistance against tyranny and against arrogance. The leader made the remark in response to a letter from Ismail Haniyeh, who heads the political bureau of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. In response to another letter from Ziad al-Nakhala, the head of the Islamic Jihad movement, Ayatollah Khamenei hailed Palestinians' victory in the face of the recent Israeli aggression. Iran's leader stressed that Palestinians will eventually emerge victorious in their struggle to free their land from the Israeli occupation. At least 279 Palestinians were killed in recent Israeli attacks against Gaza, with 69 children among the victims. The ceasefire came into force between Hamas and Israel on Friday. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, aside from the victory, how will that translate into action on the ground when it comes to the Palestinians? Will it make a difference, do you think?
I think the difference is really in confidence, and the difference is huge already, because what we've seen is, first of all, the expression of Palestinian unity internally within the occupied territories, and also, of course, now it's spilling over into the West Bank. Gaza, of course, has been there already as the largest open-air prison camp, which the Israelis regularly like to go and bomb women and children, primarily, in order to try and subjugate them. But it's this unity of purpose which is really significant. And I think that a few important things emerge. That first of all, the Palestinian the PA cannot be allowed, Mahmoud Abbas and co. can't be allowed to suppress this activism, as they have done in the past, to be fair. The fact is that Ayatollah Khamenei has pointed to the success and the victory because it's been a military success. But on the ground level, what we've seen is that for the first time in many decades, all the Palestinians were united. Gaza, West Bank, Israel. This was something which Israel had been working on for decades to enforce the national divide, if you like. Militarily, Israel certainly hurt Gaza. However, what we witnessed in the previous wars, after each war, Gaza's military capabilities kept growing. And you've seen that now it'll grow even further. I think that Israel's crimes, they were so flagrant that it erased at least a decade of collective amnesia caused by the massive propaganda that the Israelis had been doing, which actually triggered massive worldwide support to Palestinian rights as well. This also, you can see, is the external support and unity around the Palestinian cause has been totally revived by all of this. The other key factor to recognize that Israel did not dare to do a land invasion. This is very, very critical, because had they been so powerful as they try to make out in a lot of the Hasbara propaganda they do, they would have invaded. And you know, I think the message really that Ayatollah Khamenei is reinforcing is that the Palestinians must unite to continue their revolution in the West Bank with the goal of reclaiming the land and removing Israeli occupation. We can't wait for the UN or the Americans, who've got no real impartial role in this. The Palestinians must gain independence and freedom themselves.
The US is still trying to act as a quote-unquote honest broker, but many say that that's the problem. The US is not only an honest broker, but it's not contributing to any peace that could evolve between the Palestinians and Israel. So should the U.S. pull out of this role that many say is really doesn't do anything?
The U.S. has got no role to play in the Middle East whatsoever. They are not honest brokers. They never have been. They're totally partial and in league with the Israelis. $3.5 billion a year to Israel from the U.S. for its military and other, criminal crimes in that region comes from America. That's just what they show you. Of course, there are multi-billions, perhaps even up to a trillion or more of private money, which gets siphoned through not only the Zio-Arabian money men in the background, but also the Jewish extremist diaspora across the world. So, of course, what you've got is an America which is acting as a not only a cheerleader, but an active partner. And when Ayatollah Khamenei talks about the success of the Palestinians in terms of taking on tyranny and arrogance, he's not just talking about Israel. Quite clearly, the global arrogance is a term which Imam Khamenei uses very commonly for the Americans as well, and imperialism in West Asia in particular. And I think that it's clear that the Americans, along with the United Nations, which is a useless organization because the veto the Americans have there virtually renders any chance of finding any solution for the Palestinians through that institution or any other international institution, is basically left bankrupt. Because they none of these institutions can move without the American, say-so, essentially. I think that where this has taken the entire movement, and don't forget what was happening before all this, was that the Americans under Trump had put forward what they called the deal of the century. The steal of the century, really, what they wanted to do was annex Jerusalem. This is what the resistance has realized. This is why it was so important that the resistance in Palestine responded in the way it did to what was going on in terms of the bullying at Al-Aqsa of Palestinian worshippers, in terms of the takeover of the Sheikh Jarrah region in Jerusalem. This was all part of the first steps of actually occupying Jerusalem and the third most holiest site of Muslims. So the response of the Palestinian resistance has been firm. It's yielded results. The unity is, and the initiative is now back with those people who want to truly resist Palestine, not with those sellout Palestinians as well. Let's call them what they are, because there are people who are collaborators and who are collaborating with the Zionist state to make sure that the settlements continue, to make sure that Palestinians try to go for so-called two-state solutions or no-state solutions. And essentially what the Palestinian people have turned around and said in this particular battle is, look, we're not having any of it. We're going to struggle, we're going to resist, and if it means lives are going to be sacrificed, so be it.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's Saeed Mohsen Abbas, third journalist and political commentator. Thank you. Moving on, Iran's parliament speaker calls on the Islamic Cooperation Organization to adopt measures to bring the Israeli, quote, apartheid policies to an end. Khalid Buff was addressing an international conference on Palestine held in Tehran. The parliament speaker congratulated the Palestinian resistance movement for the firm resistance against the Israeli aggression. He said the regime committed what he called the most atrocious crimes in the Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian territories. The Iranian official also criticized some Arab and Muslim countries for normalizing relations with Israel. Khalid Buff said the regime's continued occupation in the past 7 decades, as well as its acts of massacre, expulsion, and displacement of Palestinians, have been designed to change the demographics of the occupied Palestinian lands. People from across the world hold rallies as they join the chorus of voices calling for the liberation of Palestine following an 11-day Israeli bombardment of Gaza. Hashtag Trending takes a closer look at viral tweets and trending comments about the issue.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. The issue of Palestine and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land has always been a matter of debate on social media. The recent escalations in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the Israeli attacks on Gaza once more brought the topic to the forefront. Hashtag Free Palestine is the trend of the day as people from all walks of life take to the streets in different cities around the world in solidarity with Palestinians and also in condemnation of the Israeli atrocities against them. As worldwide rallies are held to denounce the Israeli crimes against the Palestinians, some social media users blame certain Arab countries for failing to play an active part in condemning Israel and also in defending the Palestinian rights. Our first tweet of the day comes from Ali Muhtashim. He wrote, Why are we not witnessing such demonstrations in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and the Sultanate of Oman? Our next tweet comes from Shaz1440. They wrote, all decent people of all faiths or none are showing solidarity because the disproportionate and gratuitous violence against civilians is a strain on humanity. Also, killing children in cold blood is always heartbreaking and definitely disproportionate violence. Our next tweet comes from Nargis Parvane. She wrote, people who are there on the path of truth and justice are fearless, even without weapons. Notice this Palestinian kid.
We scare you. Adolf Abraham is better than you. You are faggot. You are terrorists. So you can make anything. All the world are with us, not with you. Yes, I am. I was born to stay there on my land. And you have gone.
You know what? This courageous girl reminded me of Ahed Tamimi, a teenage Palestinian girl who has become globally recognized as an icon of resistance to the Israeli occupation. Here we have a reply to the previous tweet by Safiya. She wrote, this kid has more courage than all of us put together. Not going to argue with that one. Then we have a tweet by Matt Walter who said, either humanity is blind or humanity is dead. Israel and its allies are doomed. They have failed the test. Zionist terror all around the globe. The tensions started when Israeli authorities forcefully evicted Palestinian families from their homes in the East Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah to replace with settlers, some of them coming from the U.S. This next tweet by Eye on Palestine reads, Israeli settler from New York explaining why he stole the house of Palestinian family in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. This should be good.
Brooklyn?
No, I'm from New York, from Long Island.
From New York. What right do you have to live here?
The right I have is that the owner of the house wants me to live here, and he wants there to be Jews living in his house, mm-hmm. and he, because I live here, because it's important to him, because not too many people want to live here.
Your position here is a political position to keep Palestinians out of it.
Not to keep Palestinians out of it, to keep Jews in it.
And therefore keep the Palestinians who were here out of it.
No, that's not. They're not coming back into here. So whether I am here, whether I am not here, whether it's me, whether it's someone else, whether it's a monkey, whether it's a giraffe, they're not coming back into this house ever.
All the way from New York to Jerusalem Al-Quds in order to keep Jews in Palestinian homes. So much for a thief.
Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The victim was shot dead near the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Regime forces claim the victim stabbed two Israeli men before being shot. The Palestinian Health Ministry said it is looking into the incident, but there has been no report on the identity of the victim yet. In recent weeks, tensions have been running high in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood due to the planned eviction of several Palestinian families from their homes. The move is part of Israel's land grab policy to expand the settlements. The International Atomic Energy Agency and Iran have agreed to extend an agreement to monitor the country's nuclear activities.
The equipment and the verification and monitoring activities that we agreed will continue as they are now for 1 month, expiring then on June 24, 2021.
Iran's ambassador to the IAEA also confirmed the decision to extend the deal that was expired on the weekend. Kazem Khadibabadi described the extension as a good opportunity for parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to remove sanctions in practice and in a verifiable manner. He said that Iran will continue to keep the pre-recorded data of the past 3 months at its nuclear sites. Back in January, Iran and the UN Nuclear Agency reached a deal under which Tehran agreed to record data pertaining to some of its nuclear activities and to keep them for 3 months. It was also agreed that Iran would share the data with the IAEA if U.S. sanctions against the country were removed in 90 days. Homolensky joined us earlier with an update on the extension of the Iran-IAEA agreements.
And the information that's going to be gathered in this next month will also be at the hands of Iran, and it's not as of yet going to be transferred to the agency. What will happen after this month is over? Now, that's the this crucial month up until the 24th of June is very important, because if there's an agreement on revival of the JCPOA, then things, as you say, will get back to normal. If there is no agreement as far as Iran is concerned, and if we consider the law that's been passed by Parliament, the level of Iran's cooperation with the AGC will only remain at the basically at the level of Iran's commitments under the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement with the agency. It was the JCPOA that gave the agency further access. So if there's no agreement, the decision by Iran that's been announced previously is that it will delete this information and it will reduce the level of its cooperation with the agency. It's still, of course, Iran is an IAEA member state. It's still a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so it has its commitments there. But, of course, the level of access will be dramatically reduced if there is no JCPOA. Even now, of course, because of this law that's been passed by Parliament, the agency does not have the access that it had before under the JCPOA. And everything is basically tied to what will happen with this nuclear agreement. Is 1 month enough to reach an agreement or not? We'll have to see.
Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says removing the sanctions imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump against Tehran is a legal and moral obligation. On his Twitter page, Zarif said the removal of the sanction is not negotiating leverage. He said the sanctions did not work for Trump and won't work for the current U.S. administration either. On Sunday, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it remains unclear whether Tehran is ready and willing to take what he called necessary steps to return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. The agreement got into trouble after the U.S. pulled out of it in 2018. Iran and the remaining signatories are now engaged in talks to revive the accord. Iran has repeatedly emphasized that Washington has to take the first step by removing all the sanctions verifiably. The World Health Organization says the COVID-19 crisis is being perpetuated by a, quote, scandalous inequity in vaccine distribution.
The ongoing vaccine crisis is a scandalous inequity that's perpetuating the pandemic. More than 75% of all vaccines have been administered in just 10 countries. There is no diplomatic way to say it. A small group of countries that make and buy the majority of the world's vaccines control the fate of the rest of the world.
And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
God, what a fragrance. Oh, wow, it's the sweetest smell of the Gole Mohammadi. Today I've come to my grandma's home, and right now I'm inside her yard where there are many shrubs of Gole Mohammadi. My grandma loves Gole Mohammadi. She dries these flowers and puts them in her tea. When she was younger, she used to make delicious and fragrant jams or the petals of Gole Mohammadi, but now that she has aged, she's not in the mood of cooking jams like those days. Well, let me go inside the home to greet with my grandma and then ask her what she likes me to bring her as a souvenir from Qamsar. You know what? I'm going to Qamsar tomorrow. Qamsar is globally known by its Gole Mohammadi. Gole Mohammadi, with the scientific name of Rosa damascena, is a type of rose which is highly resistant against dehydration. There are different types of rose flowers. Among them, the Damask rose grows in Iran. This flower grows in different regions of Iran. The most popular region in which grows the Gole Mohammadi is the city of Qamsar, located in Isfahan province. Qamsar is situated 27 kilometers to the city of Kashan. Qamsar is popular for its rose water and growing the best quality of Gole Mohammadi in Iran. Gole Mohammadi have several characteristics, including having aromatic pink half-filled petals, oval-shaped petals, 5 to 7 leaflets, and a petiole. Gole Mohammadi is a shrub with many pressed, wide, fine, hook-shaped thorns. I am now in Qamsar, in a vast plain of Gole Mohammadi. Local people are picking Gole Mohammadi, and this atmosphere is filled with the fragrance of these flowers. The fragrance which has filled here is much stronger and much more pleasant than the smell of the Gole Mohammadi shrubs which grow in my grandma's yard.
We arrive here at 5:30 a.m. in order to pick the flowers. We keep working until 4 or 5 p.m. After weighing the flowers, we send them to Qamsar for the process of rose water extraction. We put 30 kilograms of the flowers in 70 liters of water. We put the pot's lid back and let the mixture boil for 4 hours. During these 4 hours, the steam passes through these pots, then is cooled and finally changes into rose water. We extract nearly 40 liters of rose water. The essence of Gole Mohammadi has medicinal advantages. This essence is also used in the cosmetic industry for making perfumes or creams. This essence is also exported to France.
Well, I'm now in a traditional tea house, and I'm going to drink a cup of Iranian tea along with some Gul Muhammadi, which I have put in my tea. What a tasty tea. It has a sweet fragrance as well as a unique taste. And I've bought some Gul Muhammadi as souvenir for my grandma. It would make her very happy because her Gul Muhammadi shrubs are not enough for her everyday feast of tea and Gul Muhammadi. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the government, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people alike.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the future of the United States troops in the region following the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then we will explore alternative scenarios for Washington to maintain its military presence in the region.
The United States has postponed the withdrawal of its military forces from Afghanistan yet again. The Biden administration has said the troops would leave the country before the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. However, the deadline seems more symbolic than pragmatic, considering the recent rise in terrorist attacks across Afghanistan. After two decades of military presence in the country, the U.S. seems to be left with no good options.
Late in February 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed a peace agreement in Qatar's Doha. The accord was officially titled the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan, but the Afghan government was excluded from the talks. As per the provisions of the deal, Washington promised the complete withdrawal of all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan if Taliban prevents Al-Qaeda and other terrorist outfits from operating against the U.S. and its allies. Taliban also promised to engage in talks with the Afghan government and distance itself from Al-Qaeda. The United States agreed to an initial reduction of its force level from 13,000 to 8,600 by July 2020, followed by a full withdrawal by the 1st of May 2021 if the Taliban keeps its commitments. Although Taliban failed to hold up its end of the deal, Washington went on and completed its reduction of forces to 2,500 troops in January. This is the lowest number of American soldiers in Afghanistan since 2001. Many experts believe that such a low number of troops cannot have any operational value on the ground, but it could be used as a political leverage in the U.S. negotiations with Taliban. However, President Joe Biden did not use this as a bargaining chip and announced plans for the full withdrawal of the remaining 2,500 troops on September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. According to the plan, NATO troops would also follow the same withdrawal timeline.
The United States has numerous military bases throughout the world. Now may be the time to use them. The Biden administration might be looking for some alternatives to keep the American foothold in the region, to provide security for the U.S. interests and gather intelligence in Afghanistan. The U.S. needs to reside its forces close by.
The United States is now bogged down in an attrition warfare in Afghanistan and only has bad choices. No possible scenarios can be favorable for Washington. If it leaves Afghanistan for good, it loses its stand in the region after two decades of useless and costly occupation. Moreover, the U.S. has massive amount of assets and military equipment in Afghanistan that may end up in the hands of terrorists following the pullout. Furthermore, how can Washington know if Taliban is keeping up with its commitments without the proper intelligence-gathering operations? The U.S. is doomed to failure in this quagmire that it has created in Afghanistan. There is no victory in this war, as all future possibilities lead to different levels of defeat for Washington. Therefore, the U.S. will have to either find ways to linger its presence in the country or find alternatives that are less costly. It may opt for a stronger diplomatic mission, for example, through a castle embassy in Kabul or an army of contractors across the country. According to figures from U.S. Central Command, there are more than seven contractors for each U.S. military service member remaining in Afghanistan, amounting to over 18,000 contractors as of January 2021. Another alternative may be relocating forces to its numerous military bases in Asia.
I think everybody recognizes that the previous administration in the United States under President Donald Trump signed a peace treaty with the Taliban, which set a May 1st, 2021 deadline for the withdrawal of all foreign troops. That's not just American troops, but also the 7,000 plus NATO troops that are currently deployed in Afghanistan. If you check the calendar, it's past May 1st, and the Taliban have made it clear that they view this as a violation. Now, the Taliban will be clever. They're not going to do anything that will provoke the United States to keep its forces inside Afghanistan, but they also recognize that the United States is in a very sensitive political environment where, you know, we've committed to leave Afghanistan, and so the Taliban will exploit this withdrawal to try and gain military and political advantage inside Afghanistan. So they are going to be carrying out attacks against primarily Afghan security forces, but these attacks may end up involving some American, some NATO targets. But again, I believe that the Taliban would seek to minimize violence against Americans and NATO forces because they want them out of the country.
The U.S. military has presence on every continent. For most of the recent history, the U.S. claimed some existing threat and set up a military base in a region near the source of the alleged threat. But it almost never left the base afterwards. There is no exact public number for the U.S. military bases outside of its borders, but some sources say the number is between 500 and 800 in over 80 countries. It splits the world in six regions, each with its own permanent and temporary bases. Map of the bases, you see the greatest concentration of overseas bases are near Russia's population center in the east, in the Middle East, and in East Asia. These bases are everything from massive military compounds the size of towns to small airstrips in the middle of the ocean. If the United States continues its airstrikes or other so-called counterterrorism operations in the region following the supposed withdrawal from Afghanistan, it needs to be close, so all the neighbors of Afghanistan and other regional countries can be viable destinations. Some of them seem more favorable than others, such as Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, as well as Pakistan and India.
Pundits believe it is naive to think that the U.S. will leave the region for good, so its next move may involve occupying another country in the region or increasing its military presence in another country. The U.S. Central Command and American diplomats are negotiating with nations surrounding Afghanistan on agreements to base troops and aircraft for operations inside the country following the withdrawal. CENTCOM boss General Kenneth McKenzie says the command is engaged in a significant effort aimed at determining the best places for the troops. Earlier in the Afghan war, the U.S. military had agreements to operate out of large bases in locations such as Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, but it is not yet decided which countries could be considered. As a strategic friend, Pakistan seems a very plausible option, but has many obstacles because it is so close that Taliban would not see it as far enough.
After 9/11, you know, there was a different dynamic. The United States was in the revenge business. And if you stood in our way, we were going to crush you. End of story, no debate, it was going to happen. And Pakistan knew this. So even though Pakistan didn't want the United States operating, and remember that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were affiliated with the Pakistani intelligence services. They were receiving aid and training and equipment, and they were operating as a proxy of Pakistan. So Pakistan didn't necessarily want the United States to be operating, but they had no choice because they recognized the United States had to go in and exact its revenge. And so Pakistan opened up its territory. It allowed the United States to use some of its bases to operate out of. But more importantly, it allowed the United States to use its port facilities to deliver the tremendous amount of logistics, the vehicles, the fuel, the equipment were all shipped into Pakistan and trucked over into Afghanistan. And to this day, Pakistan has never totally shut that down. They've made noises, it's been difficult, some of the convoys have been blown up, and the United States was forced to go to Russia, of all places, and get the northern transit route, from Russia, across Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, into Afghanistan that way.
The countries that Washington already has bases, or some military agreements like Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, are other choices for the destination of the U.S. forces.
Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan are viable options if their governments open the bases up to the United States and if Russia continues to allow the United States to supply these bases from Russian territory. The United States would ship, and the way this worked is the United States shipped material into the Black Sea. They landed at Georgian ports, and then they were shipped by rail from Georgia onto Russian territory, and then onto Turkmenistan, through Turkmenistan, and into Uzbekistan. American military airlift capability was allowed to overfly Russian territory. The last time I checked, the United States and Russia aren't getting along too well. And I don't think Russia is going to be inclined to allow the United States to continue to have this kind of access. So without that access, without Russia saying, yes, you can use our territory to supply your bases in Uzbekistan, there are no bases in Uzbekistan.
India may also be Biden's solution. The Indian subcontinent is where the Biden administration is scrutinizing to find a hot sweet spot for the future of the forces. India seems like a place that Taliban would agree.
Of course, the U.S. may be able to find a way to pull out of the accord and not out of the country. Biden may opt to cite Taliban violations or delays in peace talks with the Afghan government as justification for maintaining an indefinite military presence or ask the Taliban for an extension of the withdrawal deadline. In any case, this means the escalation of war in Afghanistan.
The United States' negotiation with Taliban after 20 years of war is getting more and more like surrender talks. Washington has no leverage against the Taliban. It has no way to guarantee Taliban would not move to gain control over the country. Nobody is sure of Afghan security forces' capability to counter the increasing terrorist attacks in the country. Also, there is nothing to ensure that Kabul can survive the resurgence of Takfiri terrorists in the region. Many experts say if Washington had wanted to start negotiations with Taliban, it should have done it, for example, back in 2004, when the U.S. had the upper hand in the conflict. Some others say American authorities and policymakers should start learning how to end a war rather than starting never-ending wars.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by John Kiraku, American author, journalist, and retired intelligence officer. John, welcome to the program. Now let's start by asking this. Will the American forces leave Afghanistan for good? And if they do, where would they go, back home or to another U.S. base in the region?
Yes, I think that this is the real deal. I think they are going to leave. Most of them will probably come back to bases in the United States. These troops will not be relocated to bases in the region. Is that the United States negotiates troop levels with each country. And so let's say there are 500 troops at a base in, let's say, Saudi Arabia, then the limit is set at 500. If troops are leaving Afghanistan, they can't then go to Saudi Arabia because it would violate the agreement. They would have to go back to the United States or to these very large bases that we have in Germany.
Why were the U.S. forces in Afghanistan in the first place? Did they achieve their goals now that they seem to be leaving? How do you see the future of Afghanistan after the foreign troops withdrawal?
Let me answer the first part of your question first. The purpose, the sole purpose for entering Afghanistan was to destroy al-Qaeda. According to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that mission was accomplished by the end of 2001. In fact, by the end of 2001, there were no more than 50 al-Qaeda fighters left in Afghanistan. We had either killed them, caught them, or pushed them out into Pakistan or to their home countries. So there was no reason to remain in Afghanistan after the end of 2001. In terms of the future of the Afghan government, I'm not at all optimistic. And frankly, I blame the Afghans for this. You know, the United States spent about $1 trillion in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. That's a staggering amount of money. And we have nothing to show for it. We are leaving Afghanistan as a country that's unable to defend itself. It's a country that has a central government that is so weak that its officials can't even leave the capital itself. It's subject to terrorist attacks from a multitude of groups. It has poor relations with its immediate neighbors. In my view, this has been really a failure of policy over the last 20 years. And let me tell you one other thing, just as an example. The United States, about 15 years ago, hired an American defense contractor to train the Afghan National Police. They created a police academy where they could train these people, and it included a dormitory where recruits were sleeping. One of the recruits was secretly a member of the Taliban. Now, he had not been vetted. None of these recruits had been vetted. And what he did was he put poison in stew that was fed to the recruits at dinner. He killed more than a dozen of them. And many of the ones that didn't die by poisoning, he killed that night while they were sleeping. Now, after all these years, these are the issues that we still have to deal with? To me, this shows just a complete and total failure from the very beginning.
Thank you, John. We'll just give you a little break and let's take a look at how the global media has covered the issue.
President Joe Biden says the United States met its objective of attacking Afghanistan 10 years ago with the assassination of Osama bin Laden, adding that since then, our reasons for staying have become increasingly unclear, with a terror threat now in many places, keeping thousands of troops grounded and concentrated in just one country and across the billions of dollars spent each year, makes little sense to me and to our leaders, Biden said. Provincial officials from across Afghanistan have warned of mounting losses in a series of attacks, some with heavy casualties, since the United States officially began its withdrawal on May 1st. But the Pentagon insists that the withdrawal was going according to plan, with no surprises. It's not a foregone conclusion in my professional military estimate that the Taliban automatically win and Kabul falls, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters at the Pentagon. Although troops will leave, the Pentagon, American spy agencies, and American allies will maintain a less visible presence in the country. The departure will not include the 1,000 troops maintained in the country off the books, as Pentagon sources told the New York Times, including elite Army Rangers working for both the Pentagon and the CIA. More troops will remain positioned in neighboring countries, and attack planes will be within rapid reach, forewarned of insurgent fighters by armed surveillance drones. Civilian contractors may also play a role on the ground.
Thank you, John, for your wait. And now we have more questions for you, obviously. If the U.S. removes its troops from Afghanistan, will it increase its number of forces in neighboring countries such as Pakistan?
I don't think there will be an increase in the number of troops at bases in the region, especially in Pakistan. And that's because we have a very difficult relationship with Pakistan. You know, I served there in 2002, and the Pakistanis are of two minds of the United States. One, they cooperate with us like brothers on the issue of counterterrorism. On other issues, we have a very difficult relationship with Pakistan, to the point where they don't trust us on broader international issues, international affairs. They trust the Chinese. They have a closer relationship with the Chinese, economics, trade, foreign affairs, defense cooperation. But, you know, the United States abandoned Pakistan in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president because we had pushed the Russians out. And that was really our goal. It was very short-sighted. And so we just walked away from the Pakistanis. And then we went back to them in 2001 and we said, hey, we need your help again. Well, should they trust us? Are we reliable allies? I think the answer is no, at least not where the Pakistanis are concerned. Now, the Gulf states, we have very close relations with the Gulf states, but there's really no reason to increase U.S. troop strength there. You know, there's a joke here in the United States. Perhaps you've seen it on social media. It's a map of the Persian Gulf, and it has little American flags wherever there's an American base. And, of course, the bases go all the way around Iran. And it says, look at the Iranians. They put their country right in the middle of our bases.
John, this last question. Will the Biden administration consider India as bases for U.S. troops to keep their eye on the situation in Afghanistan?
I don't think the Biden administration will consider India a viable option for a couple of reasons. First of all, the Indians have never invited us, which is a big deal. We've worked hard over the years to improve relations with India, beginning during the Clinton administration. Traditionally, we had very poor relations with India because they were close to the Soviet Union. When the Soviets fell and Bill Clinton was president, he decided to open this new relationship, and it's worked. You know, we have millions of Indians living in the United States. Many of them have become American citizens. So there's this this cultural and familial tie already. But the relationship that we have is really built on trade and defense sales. We sell a lot of jets and weapons and things like that. But that's not to say that the Indians want us to actually be in India, and so they've never invited us. With that said, it would cause a huge problem in our relations with Pakistan if we were to send troops to India. This is what I meant when I said we have this difficult relationship with Pakistan. It's almost like a love-hate relationship. They don't want us to be there, but they don't want us to be in India more. And so if they were to choose the lesser of two evils, they would rather have us in Pakistan so that we would be paying them instead of paying the Indians.
Thank you, John, for your precious time. Now let's take a look at how the social media has covered the issue.
Dr. Bishnu Hari Nepal has predicted that the U.S. military would not leave Afghanistan as far as their interests are safe there. Yasser Karavan has pointed out that generations of Afghan people hate foreign forces on their soil. This account has lashed out at the American imperialist wars, underlining that Washington's call to end the violence in Afghanistan is a ruse to get out of the agreement with Taliban. This account believes that U.S. should withdraw its forces from all the countries in the region, be it Syria, Iraq, or Afghanistan.
And with this, we come to the end of our episode on the alternatives for U.S. forces after withdrawal from Afghanistan. We will meet again next week. So till then, take care and bye-bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.